What you don't know is that he gave me freedom to go on as long as I want. I didn't hear that, Walt. I'm good at that, see? Dangerous, isn't it? Dangerous. Now, as we continue in this great book, and you can just reemphasize with Rod in his prayer that we would learn the practical application of this little book. The more I study the Old Testament, and I have to admit that it's not often, or it's not as often as it should be, that we study these prophets. There's some inherent difficulties, aren't there, with these minor prophets? Excuse me, one second. Not just my daughter. Are you folks going to be okay with your neck looking up like, should I get down lower, or you're okay? Just keep moving back. You know, if we had four meetings, you'd be in the back row at the last service, I think, wouldn't you? This, well, the thing is yeah, you're hard on your neck. Well, if you're satisfied, I will inflict you with a little pain. And I can sure tell, Harold, when you're sleeping, though. You know, it's a long way down. There was some wisdom, wasn't there, of the conveners of this conference. And I'll state it that way, I guess, to have the meetings in the morning, after a dinner, and when it's nice and warm, tough, isn't it? Tough to stay awake, tough to preach. Okay, in this book, the goal that I have is to try to do to each other, or for me to do as the one that happens to be speaking to you, and for us to do with each other, as we have fellowship together, and that is to encourage one another in the work of the Lord. And that's exactly the message of Haggai. It is to be encouraged to continue in the work of the Lord. Some of the discouragement, some of the opposition that the people in Haggai's day experienced are exactly the same as we experience. There's a lot of continuity in their experiences as well as ours. And sometimes we tend to read the Old Testament and think that these people just are, that I can have nothing in common with them. I really don't understand. They lived in a different time and there's really no parallel, there's no correlation with me. And that's just not true, is it? People are the same everywhere. They have the same basic problem, and we can learn tremendous amount from them. In chapter 2, as we continue, Haggai first has operated as that cattle prod that I heard about on the way out of the donut room. I've had experience with those, by the way, on the wrong end of them, and they stink for sure. But what Haggai is doing figuratively is goading them, is stimulating them to continue with what they set out to do 14 or so years before, and which they had given up. And in chapter 2, then, he's going to give them the reasons, or he's going to encourage them with good, solid reasons that fit their needs. They were in, you'll find that there are three sections here in chapter 2, and they all have a particular need. If I had my druthers, well, maybe we'll stay for a long afternoon. Take about 45 minutes or so for each one of these, because they're full of good, solid material, really are. The more I studied them, the more frustrated I got. What in the world can I leave out is the question, and I think most of us have that problem. But what I'm proposed to do is to read each one, comment on it, try to apply it, and then read the next and go down through the three oracles that we have. In verse 1 of chapter 2, and I guess I should have said I'm reading, this is the American Standard Version, very similar to the Authorized Version, very dissimilar to some translations, but be that as it may. In the seventh month, in the 1 20th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people, saying, Who is left among you that saw this house in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes as nothing? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work. For I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. According to the word that I covenanted with you when ye came out of Egypt, and my spirit abode among you, fear ye not. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, Yet once is a little while, it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the precious things of all the nations shall come. And I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And this place will I give peace. And in this place will I give peace, saith the Lord of hosts. Again, let's commit our time to the Lord in prayer. Our Father, we again look to you for guidance and for the encouragement that we need today as we read this little book of a prophet that spoke so many hundreds of years ago to his people in their time and yet speaks to us. And we ask for your blessing in Jesus' name. Amen. One of the things you notice in the book of Haggai in the chronology that he gives, he's very careful to tell you the exact day when he preached this message in this oracle, and you'll notice each one of them starts with the day. You'll see in the second year of Darius the king that Haggai starts in the first day of the sixth month. He then, in chapter 2, starts in the seventh month and the 21st day. In chapter 3, it's in the 24th day of the ninth month, and chapter 2 and verse 10. The third oracle is the 24th day of the ninth month, and then in verse 20, it's also on the 24th day of the ninth month. So all of these oracles, these four messages, occur in the period of 4 months. Now, these times are significant, and if you were a Jew living in those days, you would understand it implicitly, and I wouldn't have to, you know, to talk about it. The first thing is that in the first day of the sixth month, that was a new moon. Each month was a new moon, and the new moons were times when they would gather together for worship, such as it was in those days. And so it was an appropriate time for Haggai's first message because they would have been gathered together for the purpose of worshiping the Lord as they were able to in their context. In chapter 2, though, we read in the seventh month and the 21st day of the month. Now, does that say anything to any of you? Probably not. But what it does to the Jew, it would say, is that this day happens to be the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles. The Feast of Tabernacles occurred on the 15th day of the seventh month, and you read in the book of Ezra that they kept the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths, in chapter 3 when they first came back. And so we assume that they kept these feasts continually through these 14 years, which is probably what they did. But this is the last day of a seven-day feast, when they would come together, a celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. And the last day is an interesting time because, if you remember from chapter 1, they experienced drought, didn't they? And they experienced crop failure. Well, the Feast of Tabernacles is to celebrate their crops. And it was called the Feast of Ingathering, or a Feast of Harvest. And it was called the Feast of Booths and the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Tabernacles has three, it's similar to our Lord's Supper, where there's a present aspect, there's a past and a future aspect, isn't there? We remember the Lord right now. We remember what he has done in the past, don't we? And we look forward to when he's going to come again. We proclaim his death till he comes. There's a present, past, and future. And the same thing in the Feast of Tabernacles. The present was a harvest festival. It's present day, or present, the time would be September. And they would have brought in the olive trees, the fruit from the various summer crops, and they would celebrate. And this was a harvest festival. And give thanks to the Lord. And so in the present, it has the purpose of being thankful to God who has given them, but God had given them very little harvest, hadn't he? So you see, their frustration would have developed out of, here we have this Feast of Tabernacles, but we haven't got anything to celebrate. And Haggai has already told them they're under the judgment of God because of it. And the other aspects, just to mention them for sake of fullness of the subject, I suppose. The Feast of Tabernacles looked back, didn't it? It was the Feast of Booths. Why? They would live in these booths, which would make of branches, and not live in their homes because they were to remember the time of walking in the wilderness. And it was in the future, and it says, I will bless you. It was to commemorate or to ask the Lord for future blessings. So it had a future aspect. And if you study the Feast of the Lord in toto, you see that there's a calendar in God's purposes there, isn't there? And I'm not going to really elaborate on that. But the Feast of Tabernacles, in that kind of an event, and I would recommend to you several books, but the primary one would be David Barron's book called Type Psalms and Prophecies, where he goes through this. He was a Jewish man, lived in the 1800s, and it's just about worth selling your home to get that book. It's out of print, but it's a very fine book. And the future, the Feast of Tabernacles, looks forward to the Millennial Kingdom, doesn't it? And I think that I will just make the statement, and then we can discuss all that typical understanding if you wish. But it had a future aspect as well, past, present, and future. Now, in this time, they had started in the sixth month, just about 3 weeks before, they had started to build. And they had built on the foundation that was laid in the book of, you read about it in the book of Ezra, chapter 3, and they had started laying the foundation, and there were people, just as in Ezra, in the first days when Zerubbabel and Joshua started building the foundation, they saw the size of the foundation, and they wept because they had seen the temple, these older folks, and they would have been in their 70s, no doubt, or older, and they had come back to the land, and they had seen the Temple of Solomon before it was raised to the ground, and they saw the foundation, and this is terrible, this is so small, it's so insignificant, it's a time of sadness, not of joy. People who had come back to the land who hadn't seen that were rejoicing because they were getting a temple. It was small, it was insignificant, but it was their temple, and God was going to dwell in it. And you notice that it says, and this is the occasion where Haggai says, now you look, doesn't it seem small, he says, doesn't it seem insignificant, doesn't it seem as nothing compared to Solomon's temple? And I'm sure it did. To those who had seen Solomon's temple, it certainly did. And I'm sure they communicated that frustration, that disappointment to their fellow Israelites. The point here that Haggai is going to deal with is that you are a remnant. You are a small group of people. What you were doing is building a temple that's small, that is relatively insignificant. It's going to seem as nothing compared to the temples in Damascus and in Persia and in Egypt. These things are small. Your temple is very small, and it looks insignificant. But I want you to remember something, that this temple and this place is going to become, and I'm going to build there, a great temple that's going to exceed the glory of Solomon's temple. And the point that he's making here is that you are part of greater things. No matter how small this temple looks, you are a part of a continuous greater program in God's eyes. There's going to be greatness here, and that should encourage you. Now, I think that always helps, doesn't it? If you can get a glimpse into the future, you know, when you're going through difficult times, whatever the discouragement, whatever the difficult times are, if you can get a glimpse and see a little light at the end of the tunnel, then that helps, doesn't it? And that's exactly what he was doing to these people. And he says, and he's going to develop it, but first of all, he says, now, I want you to do three things. First, I want you to be strong. To be strengthened by this. Take courage, in other words. Now, imagine, these are the small motley group. They're poor. Most of them, at least. They were in the middle of antagonistic people. The Samaritans, not only the Samaritans, but everyone else around them, were antagonistic to them. And as you read down through the history of Israel, you see that they were right in the middle of the the Syrians of the Greek Empire going down and conquering Egypt and ransacking Israel. And then Egypt would become powerful, and they'd go up north and ransack Israel. And they were just in the buffer zone, and they were getting it all the time. And they were feeling very, I'm sure, very discouraged at this point in time with all of the problems around them and the threats on every side. And he's saying, don't worry about it. Be strong. Take courage. I especially like the account of David in, I think it's 1 Samuel chapter 30, where David has gone down to the Philistine, and he has offered himself as, Saul is chasing him, trying to put him to death, and he's offered himself to the Philistines to, you know, fight for them. And Achish, the king, has said, that's fine, you do it. But David had fooled them, and he had gone out against the Amalekites and against the other tribes around the Philistines and had not left anyone. You know, there was a lot of duplicity in David there, but he had worked for Israel, Israel's side. But then after about a year or so, the Philistines were going to fight against Saul, and the Philistines, the rulers of the people, said, David is the one that they sang. You know, Saul is slain 1,000, but David is 10,000. You don't want to take him into battle. He's going to turn against you. And Achish said, well, David, I know that that's not going to be true. Now, David may have done it. Who knows? But Achish said, I know that's not true, but these people want you to be left. They don't want anything to do with you. And so David went back to Ziklag. In the meantime, the Amalekites had come and sacked Ziklag and had taken captive their women and children and their spoil and had left. And so David had been rejected by Saul, had been rejected by the Philistines,
And when he came back and all this happened, his men wanted to kill him. They were so discouraged and so upset with David because all of their wives and children had gone. And what it says is that David strengthened himself in the Lord. Now that, I think, is important. When all else fails, we can strengthen ourselves in the Lord. You'll read that in 1 Samuel 30, verse 6, I think it's up. Now the point here is that sometimes we tend to strengthen ourselves in our friends. We call them up and we want them to encourage us, and we depend upon them to lift us up and to get us emotionally ready. We call upon others to help us when, what should we be doing, really? First thing we should learn, the lesson, is to be strengthened in the Lord. And that's exactly what they did here. It says to be strong, to take courage, and to work. Be strong and get to work. And the third thing we see at the end of verse 5, and fear ye not. Now, they were not to fear those folks around them who were a menace to them. The Samaritans were continually a menace, and the Samaritans, this goes all the way down, they were thorn in Israel's side all the way down to the time of Christ, weren't they? These Samaritans, there was a real hatred between the two people. And this, they had the advantage. The Samaritans had been there for 200 years, and these Israelites had just come back recently and had not gained a foothold in the land. So there were a lot of threats, weren't there? A lot of threats, a lot of uncertainty. And he says, don't fear them. It was said of John Knox, I believe, that he feared no man. He feared the Lord so much that he feared no man. And he lived in days of Bloody Mary and got run out of England, you know, to save his life. And there are a number of others who feared God so much that they feared no man. And I think that's what we're seeing here. In chapter 1, it says, these people did fear before the Lord. Now, I would like to tell you my indebtedness to a man. I think Rod may know him. Do you know Bruce Waltke, Rod? Bruce Waltke, in one of the tapes I heard of him, discussed the fear of the Lord one time, and it made sense to me. And if you read in the Old Testament, the priests of Israel were told to instruct these people to fear the Lord. Well, a fear is some sense of panic or some sense of being afraid. How do you instruct somebody to be like that? I mean, you can't instruct an emotion, can you? I mean, you just are. If you're afraid, you just are. You don't teach someone to be afraid. And so what he essentially said is that this phrase, fear of the Lord, you have to take as a phrase. You can't really take it and evaluate what fear means, and then who Yahweh is, and then understand what it means. You take the phrase as a whole. It's the same thing that I have used in the idea of broadcast. You're not going to get anywhere if you look at the word broad and understand all the meanings of broad, and then look at cast and understand all the meanings of cast or the throw, and then understand that a broadcast has to be something like that. A broadcast is something that you look at a compound word, and it means a specific thing, doesn't it? It means to broadcast something over the radio. If I say something like that, that's what you're going to do. So broadcast is a compound, and fear of the Lord is a compound like that. And if you look at them, let me just look at a few of these. Turn to Isaiah chapter 50. And I want to read it to you, and then we'll just look at it a little bit in some detail. Notice in the parallelism of Hebrew poetry, we get some understanding of these words. In Isaiah 50, verse 10, it says, who is among you that feareth the Lord, that obeys the voice of the servant? Notice in the parallelism, what do we have? Fear of the Lord and obedience, don't we? And just one other. There's so many. But turn to Psalm 112. A little sword drill here. We read in Psalm 112, verse 1, praise ye the Lord. Blessed is the man that feareth the Lord. And then by way of explanation, that delights greatly in his commandments. So a man who fears the Lord delights greatly in his commandments. And you all know in the Proverbs that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, of real wisdom. So as you look at this idea, the basic thing I want to simply say is that there are two aspects to fear of the Lord. The first is, if you're going to teach someone the fear of the Lord, you teach them who the Lord, Yahweh, is. He is the creator of the universe. He's the one who is sovereign over history. He is omnipotent. He is the God of the Old Testament. And you teach them who Yahweh is. Now, once you teach somebody who Yahweh is, you have two choices. Only two. Once presented with the fact that this is the creator God of the whole universe, then either you reject it and say, I'm going to live as I want to live, or you submit to it. And you unconditionally place yourself underneath the creator God of the universe, which means, in synonym, is that you obey what he tells you to do. So to fear the Lord is not, I don't think it's simply to have an awe. It is to have an awe of God in the sense that you then obey and you submit to what God tells you to do. And if you fear the Lord, the corollary is that you won't fear men, will you? You want to obey God because he is the sovereign. And the fear of men then wanes, doesn't it, in its significance. And that's what I think is the idea here in Haggai, where it says to fear the Lord. They feared the Lord. They understood who God was. They didn't have to be taught a whole lot. But they then placed themselves unconditionally under the authority of God, of Yahweh. And that's what I think it means, to fear the Lord, which is to obey him. And if you do that, which means you will obey everything,